We're going to do a bunch of the stuff that we'll do in terms of using computers will be as simple as what I asked you to do just now, which was to plot something in R. And so what I asked you to do just before the break was to do something like this. Plot those deviates, that sequence between 0 and 1, and then look at those deviates given the density of the beta. And the plot looks like this. There, I had a question just before the break, or just as we started the break, of what this does. So in R, it's generally a good thing about R is it's very easy to take the code apart. Okay? And so we can look at, well, what does just this part do? Well, it just gives us a sequence of numbers between 0 and 1 by whatever offset we specify. Okay? And many of you have done the same type of thing with integers before. And that's just a shortcut to sequence 1, 5 by an integer of 1. Okay? So it's a very easy way to get series of numbers. And in our case, there's no intrinsic value of those numbers, but those are just deviates along that scale, and we want to measure the height of our function at all of those deviates. Does that make sense? We could have easily, particularly in this case, specified half the scale. We could have changed this from 0.5. And, well, I think I... What did I do? Oh. I just didn't get my copy and paste to work. So then we just have a different interval where we're evaluating. You could do this numerically, right? Actually, the beta is not that hard. You could say p to the alpha parameter times 1 minus p times the beta parameter, or raised to the beta power. Okay? So that gives us a sense of our uncertainty in allele frequency, the true allele frequency in the population, having done this much of sampling, 100 individuals, right? And this is that distribution graphically. What if we wanted quantiles from this distribution? What did we say we could do? We could sort them and look at the first 2.5% of the observations to get one of the quantiles. The 97.5. And you could do that through low-level programming if we had, and that would apply if we had a simulation-based approach to our analysis. But we actually have the theoretical distribution. We have the precise answer for the density at all of the values. We don't just have samples from the posterior distribution. We know the distribution. So we can use the Q-beta interface. So all the different probability distributions in R have different interfaces. You can draw random numbers from them. You can evaluate their density. That's why we use the D beta. Or Q beta gives us the quantiles of our beta distribution with those parameters and actually reports them. It's the theoretical full solution for that.
So I just want to know, if you're doing that dynamic model, the 0.8 will become your wire after the second round, or how would it work? Like, because you start with no knowledge, but then you have the 0.8.
You don't have to. You wouldn't have to do your new model and have it be dependent on your previous model. But that is a modeling choice you could make. But that's a separate issue.
And keep it as an
uninformative prior.
Yeah.
Yeah, suppose we wanted to estimate allele frequencies. We went and gathered this sample. We got an estimate of, we actually haven't calculated the mean of this theoretical distribution yet, but it's around 0.8. We want to compare that to a different allele frequency. That's commonly what we want to do. We want to go the next year, or we want to go to another population and ask, are the frequencies the same or not? Okay, so that wouldn't involve any dynamical programming. We just have a model for the allele frequency in one population and a model for the allele frequency. Another, we compare our parameter estimates. Okay? I mean, I could imagine why dynamical things would come up, but you wouldn't need to do that. There's a question over here as well. Maybe it went away. Went away? Okay. So let's look at the interface to the Q-beta. So all probability distributions have this. So if you want to look up quantiles of the normal distribution, you could do it with this type of interface. But we're looking at quantiles of the beta. So we need to say, well, which quantiles do we want? And we specify that, oh, we want the 2.5% quantile. And let's say we want the 97.5. And this is in the code, I believe. I'm just typing it. And we want to give it our shape parameters. And I'll just give them in order. And so those are the theoretical quantiles for the 2.5% and the 97.5% quantile with those parameters, that alpha and beta into the distribution.
So is that like a 95%
quantile? It is like that. It is a credible interval, and there's a slight distinction, which is that this interval is the true probability, or is the probability that the true parameter falls within that interval. A 95% confidence interval, you wish it were that, but it's not. But I'm not going to go into that anymore, because I've already raked likelihood over. The 95% confidence interval is the probability that if you repeatedly did this experiment many, many, many times, 95% of the times you redid that observation, it would be in that interval. But whether it's true or not is a separate question. It's just the method that you have used to calculate your parameter will give you that estimate 95% of the times. Whether it's true or not is a different issue. So this is what we expect, or we have 95% confidence that the true parameter lies in this interval. That's why I think we should teach Bayesian methods from the beginning, because that's what we're interested in, not in the repeated execution of experiments thousands of times, because we don't do that. Okay, the point estimate for the beta. We haven't talked about that. The point estimate for the beta, and I'm going to write it in R, but you can't type this. This is because I just don't have two screens at once. The mean of a beta, the expectation, is equal to alpha divided by alpha plus beta. So neither alpha nor beta represents the mean or the variance. It's a weird distribution. To calculate the mean, you have to do this. Okay? So what are we going to do? We're going to calculate 161 over the sum of our alpha and beta, so 41 plus 161. That's our point estimate. That is the mean of our theoretical distribution. That is the mean of our posterior distribution for allele frequency. It's different than our other point estimate of 0.8. It's very close. And the credible interval around that reflects our uncertainty in the parameter. Okay, but this is the Bayesian point estimate for the allele frequency. It's 0.797. And as we did just a moment ago, we can look at the quantiles of that distribution. We okay? We're on board? So my question before the break was, how will sample size affect things? We sampled 100 individuals in this case. Let's suppose we only sampled 10. Okay? So that instead of having 200 allele copies, we have 20. Let's suppose our allele frequency were the same. Okay? How would we have to change this result for our beta, our theoretical beta, now that we have only 20 samples, 16 of which are the one allele, and 4 of which are the other allele, right? That would be the analogous case. We just have reduced the sample size down to 10. What do we need to do to this expression?
Just change the choice.
this. Change this to 17, and change this to 5. Boy, look, our confidence in our allele frequency changes. And it changes appreciably. But this is a key issue when we're doing population genetics. I know I need to sample probably more than 10, but where do I need to stop relative to 100? Well, you now have the math for it to plot on the x-axis the number of individuals you sample for a given allele frequency. We chose 0.8 in this case, and how it will affect your confidence in your estimate. I don't know, I hope that's useful to you. Okay, that is a real tool, because you can say, I know what my confidence, my estimate will be across a whole bunch of different allele frequencies. Okay, and you can do the math, and you don't need software to do population genetics. I guess that's one of my points. I guess this is software, but you can write the equation for this. We had the algebraic expression for this density just a minute ago, right? It's just p raised to the one parameter, 1 minus p raised to the other parameter. Okay? So that's an illustration of a closed form solution. And as I said, this is a rare case in population genetics. We have a very simple model where a beta prior makes sense with a binomial likelihood. And we know that when we multiply those two things back, we get a beta posterior distribution. This is a rare case. Yes? Yeah, what is the absolute value of it mean? Yeah. Yeah, so the question was, what does that vertical axis mean? It looks weird. You told us that probability distributions add up to 1, and the point estimates are greater than 1. And so it's a relativized measure. The probability density at every individual point, it's a continuous distribution, adds up to 1, if we wrote an integral for it. But to be able to evaluate the density at a point, we have to abstract that, right? At a point, as you go to the limit, it has zero density, right? And so this is an abstraction, because there are an infinite number of points for p, so individually they have no density, but in sum, they sum up to 1. That's my best attempt at an answer for that. Yes?
So can you scale out to the area over the...
No, you can calculate, you can use... I mean, you can integrate. If you want to do the calculus on that equation that we had, you could sum the area under the curve from one deviate to another. And in fact, we use that relationship right here. The area under the curve from 0.58 to 9.17 is 95% of the density. It's 0.95. That's the sum between those two points. And that is based on integration. But, yeah. So in practice, you won't have to do the integration yourself. R is very nice in that it has all these values that can look it up for you. Okay. So I wanted to play a little bit more with beta distributions and probability distributions. I need to grab something out of my bag. I think I'm right in thinking that beta distributions are unfamiliar. And so we've just written a little plot function there where we were plotting betas. We should goof around with that a little bit, because I've said it can be U-shaped, it can be multimodal, it can be all kinds of different shapes. Let's look a little bit at the beta distribution and some of its features, and say some things generally about probability that we need to know. And so I'm going to stay in R to do this. Rather than continually typing this sequence of 0 to 1 with some type of offset, I'm just going to save that, and I'm just going to call that, if it's OK with you, I'm just going to call it P, because then I have to type less. OK, so those are just deviates that we're going to look at of a beta distribution.
Can you use a different variable?
Sure. All right. I thought about that, and so I was going to do this, p deviates. So we can do that, too. I'll just type a little bit more. But those are just values, just arbitrary values. And we're not actually modeling anything. We're not in our example anymore. We're talking about probability distributions. And if I could use the overhead camera and the computer at the same time, I would be at notes 1.3, probability distributions. Actually, let's write that here. I do have this. So we're starting a new section, 1.6, probability distributions. And our first thing we're going to do is we're going to explore the beta just a little bit more, because that's one of our least familiar ones. And I'll make some general comments about probability distributions, and I'll turn my computer off. So we were just plotting deviates like this. And I'm going to just put in some numbers, 0.1 and 0.1 as our parameters. So these are much smaller than what we were looking at just a moment ago. And I'm going to add X labels, so P deviates, and I'll put Y lab there as the density. And we'll make it align as we did before. So as I said yesterday, when the parameters of the beta go below 1, the beta becomes U-shaped. And this is extremely U-shaped. This would be a nice probability distribution if most of our observations are near 1 or near 0. Okay, where they're really almost two alternatives, but it's still a continuous distribution over that whole range, and there's some density. Okay. Also, give me a chance to drink some coffee. Okay, so we have 0.1, 0.1 as our parameters. Let's add some lines to that, so some alternative beta distributions. So we'll change it to 0.9, 0.9, and we'll make it red. A little bit harder to see. You'll be able to see it better on your screen. But the density is very flat. It's very close to 1-to-1. There's a little uptick at the corners that you'll be able to see better on your screen. Of course, 0.9 is very close to 1-1 as your parameters. But we have a slightly higher probability at the margins. Let's keep going. What comes after red? Blue? And let's go to 2-2. Still pretty flat, but now it's hump-shaped. Okay, so it's becoming become unimodal rather than bimodal with high points at the ends. Let's jump up to 10-10. And we start to get a really nice hump-shaped distribution. In fact, just like with our previous observation where it was a bell-shaped curve, it actually can look a little bit like a normal distribution that's truncated between 0 and 1. And so in some cases, you might want to use a beta for something that looks bell-shaped, but is truncated at 0 and 1, and importantly, is positive, because one of the inconveniences of the normal distribution is that it can be negative, and many of our organisms don't do negative things. So that gives us some sense of the beta. One thing that's missing is that all of these are symmetrical distributions, right? They have equal density on the left and the right, and the expectation in all cases was 0.5. And if you think about that, a beta 1, 1, I said the mean of a beta is alpha over alpha plus beta. So it's 1 over 2. 10, 10, it's 10 over 20. Okay? You're just getting more and more density near the expectation. To make that point, let's go up to 100, 100. It might go off my axis. No. So the expectation is still 0.5, but we're reducing the variance in the expectation because we have more observations of the two categories, you can think of it that way, that we know that the true parameter is very likely close to that. Okay. So, but all of these have been symmetrical. Let's make an asymmetrical one, where alpha over alpha plus beta is not 0.5. And here I've made one with 5/15. So 5 over 20, 1/4. The expectation is 0.25, and that's the variance around it. Okay, so it can be an asymmetrical distribution as well. For allele frequencies, in some cases that might make sense for the problem you're working on, but in many cases it won't. For allele frequencies, often we'll be working with symmetrical distributions because we're going to arbitrarily make one of them the reference and one of them the alternative of allele. But if in your system it makes sense to have a categorical, this is the reference allele and this is the alternative, then you might have these type of asymmetries that are shared across loci. But a lot of times you're going to use betas that are symmetrical. Are there any questions about that? While I turn my computer off and get back to this, spend a minute playing with the beta, okay, and make some absurd betas. You can make betas that have almost all the density at one end. How could you do that? So it looks exponential. How would you do that? Yeah, 10,001. Try it, okay, and I'll get my computer turned off. Okay, so you got a chance to play with some things? Do you have any questions about the beta distribution? I expect if you ever want to look up the variance, or you want to know what the variance of a beta distribution is, you will have to look it up. I cannot memorize it. It escapes my brain. Okay, it's a combination of alpha and beta.
When you record, so what we did, we looked at the mean, and then the quantiles, so you would report like the median?
You could, often you'll see both reported, but your expectation from the distribution is the mean.
Okay.
But if you want to know what is the median, that, you know, can be quite different than your expectation as well, and so it could be interesting to know the centrality as by that measure as well. Okay, I want to say a few more things then. We talked about the beta and we've illustrated it. I suspect it was pretty unfamiliar, but it's super cool. So this could be like your summer. What did you do this summer? I learned about the beta. I don't know. Maybe that wouldn't thrill you. Yes.
As we lower the number of individuals, the
It doesn't have to. So the number of individuals. None of these things. Oh, you're. Did I get it wrong with my example of? Very slightly it shifts it, right? And so before, what Elizabeth is talking about is that before our new parameters, our parameters for the posterior distribution were a sum of our observations plus the prior, right? And the prior was one. The prior will have a larger, it's going to be fractionally larger relative to those numbers of observation if you have few, right? So if you only have five and five, one is a big number relative to five. And of course, it's going to affect, if you have no data, you will update the, in your likelihood, you don't update and you still have the original parameters. You're still at your beta 1-1. So that's worth thinking about. But actually that gives you a gauge of how much influence the data have, is how much the posterior changes relative to the prior. And so one of the things that you could do, this is an aside, is that before our prior for allele frequencies looked like this, right? This was the prior line. But at the end, we look like this. Right, that was our posterior distribution. And so we can gauge the influence of our data by comparing the posterior distribution and the prior. If those two look very similar to one another, graphically or mathematically, and are unchanged mathematically, then the data have had very little influence. But if you shifted from a uniform distribution to something like this, clearly it has a big effect. If you had less data, you know, you might move to something like this, right? And have much less of an, your data will have much less of an influence and update your prior beliefs much less. Did that get at you? And you can gauge it. I mean, that's one of the fun things. With this closed form thing, you can actually examine directly, empirically, how much do data matter. Okay. I was joking about the beta and that, you know, maybe you'll be happy that you learned it this summer. I want to say a couple things about the binomial, too. What were you going to ask?
If you choose a prior that is informative and that would look too similar to your posterior, would you then kind of, like, be misled and say, like, it didn't update so that there is no solution or something like that, or...?
You can say that your data have no further information about that parameter and that you're stuck where you were before. You could have not spent all that money to gather data. That's happened. It's a bummer.
So it's always, when you said that kind of already, so it's always the best to have the least informative prior?
I wouldn't say that. If you have a lot of information previously, you want to update your prior beliefs according to the amount of information. If you have a little experiment with 30 individuals and people have done tens of thousands of things previously, you want to update. And there are actually ways of quantifying the conflict between that prior distribution and your new likelihood given the data. When you have data. So you can measure prior likelihood conflict. There are ways of measuring that mathematically. Okay. So let's talk binomial for just a minute, because while it's familiar, because it's coin tossing, it is unfamiliar in another way. And it can be a little bit weird. And it relates to our example here. We saw in our data 160 samples of A and 40 samples of T. And then we estimate a parameter in that case. We estimated a parameter for that allele frequency. We're interested in the parameter P. And there is a complementary parameter, 1 minus P. That's actually not the way I wanted to illustrate that. I apologize. Please disregard that. The way I want to illustrate this is this, is that the contrast between the beta and the binomial is this. The binomial is a discrete distribution, okay? It cannot take an infinite number of values. It can take A or T, right? And you get a count of value. The Bernoulli trial that gives rise to the binomial can be 0 or 1. You can have one outcome or the other. And the sum of all those outcomes in those two categories will always be discrete, okay? And the probability that we get for different binomial outcomes, the numbers of successes, out of our 200 trials, how many of them were A, though that is a discrete distribution. Discrete distributions, that actually doesn't, I think, give people very much difficulty. But in the case of genotype probabilities, we don't have between 0 and 200 successes. We have two allele copies, right, in an individual. When we're thinking about the possibilities that exist, there are three discrete outcomes. We could think of this as two copies of the reference allele, 1 or 0. So that is our distribution. Those are our deviates that are possible. So before we were thinking about deviates of P, those are our three deviates that are possible from a binomial distribution with two trials. Right? We're doing two draws from the frequency of that allele within the individual. And so we have those three categories, and we end up with a distribution. Before, I think I drew it as this, that has this density. There are three possible deviates. They sum to 1. That is the whole posterior distribution for genotype. That's weird. That's why it took me a second to get what it was that I wanted to illustrate. Right? Because what's the expectation of that distribution? So what is the mean genotype of that individual? Or what are the quantiles of that distribution? Where's the median? That's an easy one. Where's the median of that distribution? Where is half of the density? Where at that deviate, 50% of the observations lie above and 50 lie below? AA. I'm pretty sure the mean's in there. As well. I don't have to do the math of 2 times 0.99 plus 1 times those and get an expectation from that distribution. But this is a weird distribution to deal with. When we're dealing with a binomial, we're used to dealing with large numbers of trials. But with genotype probabilities, with diploid organisms, with polyploids, you'd have 4 trials. And you'd have more possible outcomes and more categories. But here we have 2 trials, so we only have 3 possible deviates in our probability distribution. That is a posterior probability distribution. We can do all the stuff to it that we would typically do, but it's a weird one. I hope you agree. Okay? You would draw it. You can't draw it in terms of it's categorical, so we'd have 0, 1, 2 in terms of our deviates for genotype. If it's an unknown, and we could make a little bar plot that's summed up to 1. But there are only 3 categories. It's a probability distribution. Okay? Does that help, maybe? I'm sure that you will end up at some point wanting to deal with genotype probabilities. And you need to recognize that that is what that is. That is a posterior distribution for it. However you calculate it. We didn't talk about how the math might give rise to those probabilities, but it's a categorical distribution with very few deviates. The other thing that I wanted to say about these distributions, or at least write down because I've already said it, is that the beta can be generalized as a Dirichlet. So it's D-R-R-I. That's a multivariate generalization. So the beta only had two possible outcomes. The Dirichlet can have any number of possible outcomes. So if you have haplotypes and you want to estimate their frequencies instead of just allele frequencies of the reference allele and the alternative, but you have a large number of alleles, you would use the math we just used with a Dirichlet. And so a Dirichlet just has a bunch of alpha parameters.
So does the Dirichlet have the same property that if you multiply by, I guess in this case, would it be a multinomial?
That is very good. There's a multinomial generalization of the binomial. And just in the same way that the binomial has as its conjugate prior the beta, the multinomial has as its conjugate prior the Dirichlet. And so what that means is that the posterior distribution is a Dirichlet with updated parameters in just the same way. It's entirely analogous to what we just did. And you could do the algebra very easily to show how that works. So if you're working in SNP land, it's beta binomial. If you have multiple allele segregating a locus, it's Dirichlet multinomial. And if you've looked at the structure, Pritchard 2000 paper, like I asked or suggested that you do before the conference or our workshop, it's all multinomial Dirichlet. Okay, so it's a generalized thing because they were thinking about a locus that has any, they weren't thinking just about SNPs. Okay. I would say in terms of additional reading, if you want to learn more about this, Ben Bolker has a nice book, Ecological Models in R, I think is what it's called, is one option. In a chapter, I think, called Likelihood and All That, there's a section called A Bestiary of Functions. That can be useful. It's a nice table. It doesn't give some of the things that you would want to. You might want to look in other books. So Sally Otto and Troy Day's book has a nice section, I think, on probability distribution. So there are a number of places where you can pull together information about lots of different distributions. But binomial beta uniform will get you a long way. At some point, you want to learn about the gamma and just generally learning about Poisson processes and all the different distributions that result from Poisson processes, that pays off big time. So, and one of you has had a computational biology for me as a class. We spend a whole bunch of time talking about Poisson processes and all the different distributions that arise from it. I think it's really worthwhile. Okay, the gamma is a generalization of the exponential and all this cool stuff. Okay, but if you take a Bayesian probability class at some point, you will talk about that as well. I will finally say, before I get away from probability distributions, that if you look in a book on probability for the Dirichlet, there's a very good chance you won't find it. Wikipedia is actually quite good for probability distributions. I think on the Wikipedia page for the Dirichlet, there's a cool animation even. And they can't do that in books anyway, so they just gave up. All right, so let's talk about hierarchical models for allele frequencies, because we've set the basis for doing some useful stuff. We had a pretty naive model there, right? And so let's go through, starting with that model that we just had, think about some of the assumptions that are there and make it more and more general, okay? I'm gonna walk through some things that you've potentially seen before, but we're gonna do it in an organized fashion. So let's think about hierarchical models for allele frequencies. So So the model we just had, for example, had known genotypes. I want to build a model that has genotype uncertainty. We're going to get to a model in this section for pooled data, because a bunch of you are interested in that. Some of this parallels something that is in a paper from this year that I suggested for reading from molecular ecology that Zach and I wrote. It was in molecular ecology. It's how low should we go for sequencing coverage. And so we use some of these models there. And I'm going to steal one of the figures from that for talking about this. So let's make things just a little bit more general by thinking about a multi-locus model for allele frequencies, because we're going to analyze genomic data so that we have more than one locus that we're sampling from the genome. So several loci in individuals. And so we're going to index loci with J. Okay, we're going to use a subscript. I'm going to try to make things slightly more general. We're going to now be modeling not just one allele frequency P. I'm going to put a little vector above it, because it's a vector of allele frequencies. We're going to model allele frequencies at a bunch of different loci. That's what that little arrow up above, that means that it's a vector. And that's still going to be given our data. And we know what form that will take, don't we? What are the components that we need to do, we need to write down to specify a model for allele frequencies? Well, we know that if it only includes these two things, if that's what we're trying to estimate, that we can use Bayes' theorem, that vector, or we could actually write it now as our P sub J, each one of those, times the prior probability of P. And now we're going to take the product across all of our loci. So a big sigma sign there would be summation. A big pi sign in front means multiply all those terms. Okay? And the reason we're going to multiply is we're going to consider the joint probability of all of those data, given the parameters. Okay? When we consider the joint probability, we multiply.
So for the prior, is it P by itself, or would it be the PJ or the P vector?
The way I've written it right now is I'm saying that there's a prior probability that's shared between all of them. Okay? And so we're not indexing it, in this case, by P sub J. We're going to do that in the next model. And in fact, I think if I... Yeah, exactly. And so I was just looking at my notes to see where I was going. That's where I was going. So for our prior, we've made a choice here that this is constant, or at least shared, amongst all loci. If we made it like we did before, beta 1, 1, that distribution, then it truly is constant. We're not estimating it, right? We're saying that all allele frequencies are equally likely, and that we'll obtain an estimate for the allele frequency at each locus, just like we did previously, right, in our previous model. So there's no sharing of information amongst loci in this model, right? We could do this model, and we'd get the same results if we treated each locus independently and just did the closed form solution we just did a minute ago, or if we did it them simultaneously and put all the data in at once, it'd give us the same answer, because we're assuming they're all independent of one another. How much do you guys like that assumption? What do these loci share?
Their
lots. So what are some of the things they share? Pardon? They could be linked. Okay, so the allele frequency at one locus might be affected by linkage. Depending on what type of thing we're saying, that might be something that we could take into account. So they share a genome and they're linked. What else do they share that's important?
They share demographic history.
Well, that's much nicer than I was going to say. They share their demographic history. I was going to say they share a population, which means they share a population size, which means that they share an amount of drift. But saying demographic history, that incorporates possibilities for changes in population sizes and migration rates, all that. Okay, they share that, and in fact, if we assume all loci are neutral or at least have the same demographic history, then we can learn about that shared history by combining all this data in a hierarchical way. We're not doing that in this model. We're assuming we can't do that. So let's make a more complicated model. So let's make a multi-locus model for not just allele frequency, but also, we'll call it diversity. So we'll relax our assumption of beta 1-1. So we'll start out in the same way. We're estimating our vector of allele frequencies given some data. It's still going to be a product across all loci. The likelihood portion will stay the same.
I had a question here for this debate. Why is also a vector, right?
I just didn't write it that way.
And this product, shouldn't this product be So shouldn't you have like yj conditional on p vector rather than?
Yeah, I may not be very strict with my. I'm making suggestions with my notation because the thing
was this conditional probability on the right hand side under the product sign is p yj conditional on p a little pj. So it's.
We could say, we could add this J there. But when I can get rid of notation, I try to. So we have our likelihood, that stays the same. What we're talking about is we now want to have a prior for our PJs. And we're not going to stop there. We're now going to make it dependent on some other parameter. It's going to be conditional on some other parameter that's going to allow us to have information sharing amongst loci. Okay? And so I'll write theta here. And to complete a hierarchical model, we then need a hyperprior, is what it's called. We haven't talked about that yet. It's just another type of prior. I wouldn't worry about it. That's why I often forget to mention it. But that's what people mean with a hyperprior. It's the prior at the far side of a model if there are conditional priors in between. Okay, so this is a conditional prior because it isn't merely a prior probability on that parameter, but it's conditional upon theta. So this term right here now has a parameter that we're going to estimate. One option for doing that is to keep that prior probability for P, it can still be a beta distribution, which is what we had before. We had beta 1-1 before. Let's keep it a beta, but now have it have two parameters, theta, theta. Okay? So that we can estimate this theta right here. In the process of doing our modeling, now we're not just going to estimate P, we're now going to estimate theta. And so over here, we'll add in theta in the left side of the equation, which I should have done before. Right here, I just added this. So now it's free to vary. theta isn't going to be 1, 1, which is what it was in the previous model. It's now free to vary. And we can estimate it in the process of, in this estimation problem. So we need to have a prior on it. What are the parameters of a beta? We were just playing with that, right? What can they be? Can they be negative? No, we can't have any negative observations. We can have a very small number of observations, right? We can go down to very close to zero. Are they bounded on the top? We went up to 100, 100, I think. It goes to infinity, okay? And those two parameters in combination affect both the mean and the variance. The sum of these thetas, if it's really big, do we have a big variance or a low variance? A really low variance, right? We get the most variance when it gets U-shaped, right? And so the bigger the value gets, the lower our variance is. And so we could put some prior on this. It should be pretty flat, okay? We're going to choose something that's flat, but that has some range that allows us to have high variance and low variance, okay? And so for sake of simplicity, we'll just make this uniform over some interval. Let's make it big. 1,000 would be pretty big, right? We have some idea of how much variance that would be, right? 1,000 over 2,000 would be a super tight distribution in the beta. You can make it 10,000. It doesn't really matter. We just want to have some interval that's bigger than the posterior distribution, okay? And substantially bigger. So what is this theta parameter going to tell us? The P tells us the allele frequency, or the P sub J's tell us the allele frequencies at all the loci. This is this prior distribution. We played with this. It can be all kinds of different shapes. Right? Those are three extremes. It can be flat, it can be hump-shaped, or it can be U-shaped. So it tells us something about the prior allele frequency for any given locus. And so if we observe something that looks like this, if that's what our estimated beta is, what is that telling us about the prior probability? If that's our estimate of theta, what is that telling us about the prior probability of allele frequency at any given locus?
That it's more likely to have one common and one rare allele?
Mm-hmm. And when does that happen in demographic histories?
Recent expansion?
Recent expansion...
Population
drift? It suggests that there's been drift, right? That you have a common allele and you have a rare allele, and that you're near fixation for some reason. If you had a population instead that looked like this, where across loci in the genome, intermediate allele frequencies are common, you have a population that's supporting, for whatever reason, population growth and not very much drift, or really large population size is supporting a lot of diversity, or you know something about the demographic history that includes migration. Kevin, did you have a question?
Oh, could you complicate it more by adding like the site frequency spectrum?
This is the site frequency spectrum.
Are those mostly skewed?
What's that?
Are those sort of mostly skewed more to rare frequencies?
So what? The site frequency spectrum, when Andy was talking yesterday, I actually Googled all the different ways to draw on the site frequency spectrum. This is frequency, right? It's P. It's the allele frequency at the locus. And this is across all loci in the genome, not the count of allele copies of the different type, but the frequency itself. And it's summarizing it across the genome. And so it's combining information from this level in the hierarchy, so these Ps, to allow you to estimate this theta. How much variance in allele frequencies is there? From a purely statistical standpoint, we can see that theta is quite interesting, right? It's just interesting from a statistical standpoint. By that mean, it's just as a summary statistic, as in summarizing the allele frequency spectrum across a genome. One thing that's different relative to the plots that we saw yesterday for allele frequency spectra is that there's usually an ancestral and a derived, and so that you only see one side of this. What I'm saying is that we're not polarizing this, because across the genome, we're not talking about reference and allele and alternative. It's arbitrary which one is this. So we're looking at both sides of the allele frequency spectrum. So you might be thinking, oh, I'm used to looking at them as just this C. This is just the mirror of it. Yes?
I just want to know if those graphs represent a single locus. If you have loci that behave very differently, how do you plot that?
What we're assuming in this model is that all of these individual P sub J's come from a common distribution, this common distribution. Now, you might want to stratify your loci but for example, synonyms and non-synonymous sites. And you could estimate separate thetas for sites that you have different, that category of annotation, synonymous, non. You might want to stratify them by intergenic or genic. Okay, so you absolutely could do that. And if you have genomic data, you're going to have lots of information to estimate those different thetas, and you're going to have a really robust framework in which to compare them, because you'll have posterior distributions for those thetas. And you can model them as being independent and having independent parameters, or having some common mean and some deviation from it. So you can do really useful stuff with simple math, this simple math. So. And like basic stuff in PopGen that we would have liked to have done 30 or 40 years ago, but A, we didn't have the data, and B, we didn't have the models. So, okay. So theta is interesting just from a statistical standpoint. I mentioned yesterday that under certain conditions, theta is roughly 4n mu. Remember that from all that time ago yesterday? That under an infinite islands model or under descent from a common ancestor, it will represent that. And if the only two things that are operating are mutation and drift. And so it's a very good estimator of theta and is useful. If those conditions hold. If they don't, it's still useful statistically, and I'm happy to think about it in terms of diversity, whether it's is directly relatable to those parameters. Remember what I said about transformation. That we can take our allele frequency estimates and, for example, transform them to give us heterozygosities. Right, so that we can get the expected heterozygosity as 2p times 1 minus p. And that we can use our posterior estimates here for p and just simply transform them to get posterior estimates for heterozygosity across all of our multi-locus models. And we haven't made the simplifying assumption of beta 1,1. We've relaxed it. So you could look at heterozygosity across your genome with a simple binomial beta uniform product. Okay. One of the things I should say right now is that is probably obvious to you is that we have a binomial times a beta times a uniform. We do not know the shape of that distribution analytically. Okay. So right away, we're already now in MCMC land. Okay. To estimate this, we need to use MCMC methods because we don't know analytically what that posterior distribution is. But there's simple methods to do it. So this model we could do very easily in JAGS. Okay? And it would do the sampling for us. We wouldn't need to know how to implement Metropolis Hastings or know which parts of it can be updated in different ways.
So why wouldn't you describe the uniform as beta? And if you did that, would you be able to
You wouldn't want to do, you, I mean, there are ways that you could, okay, I'll slow down. Then it would be a binomial times a beta, and we still have no analytical solution for that. Okay, we have an analytical solution for the first part, but when it becomes multiplied by a beta, we don't have an analytical solution for that posterior. The first way I was going to answer it was that we don't want it to be bounded by 0 and 1, and because we want our variance to maybe be very small, so large, large values beyond 1. And so that's why it's nice to have the uniform, be able to go beyond 1. But that said, you can rescale the beta for so it can go to large values. So that wasn't the issue. All right. So now we have two models. And now I guess we'll get to one that you're maybe excited about, which is one with genotype uncertainty.
First, the posterior distribution that you're estimating is one distribution for all of these loci and all of these different, can you elaborate?
Yeah, yeah. So that's a good question. Right here, when I'm writing in a messy way, the probability of a bunch of different p-values, the allele frequencies at all those loci, and the probability distribution for one theta that is shared by them. So you would get a posterior distribution for each one of your p's and a posterior distribution for your one theta that is shared amongst all of them. And so if we had 100 loci, we'd be estimating 101 parameters. No, in this model now we're estimating theta and there's information sharing about theta from all the different loci. Because the prior probability for any given locus allele frequency is theta, and so the data will feed through the model. So the data will affect our individual locus estimates and the individual locus allele frequency estimates as they combine will affect our estimate of theta. So for example, if all of our allele frequency estimates, every single locus were 0.5, every one, and we had 100 loci, we would get an estimate of theta that gave us an expectation of 0.5 and a very small variance around that. If at our 100 loci, we had any allele frequency possible, 100 different ones, and they were really dispersed, like sequenced from 0 to 1 by 0.01, that type of dispersed, we would still get a point estimate of 0.5 coming out of our posterior distribution for theta, but it'd have very high variance. Okay? So our the shape of our theta distribution will be informative, and it will come from the data for individual loci, how they affect their allele frequencies, and how that then informs of our estimate of theta for all the individual frequencies. I saw another hand up, but I don't
know. So one of the things that we're interested in is finding these loci that have some kind of outlier behavior and are interesting. Is having a single theta value going to mess with that?
No, you could look at your point estimate of p in the quantiles of that distribution and see whether there were exceptional loci that just didn't seem very probable. It's a little bit weird because it's bounded by 0 and 1, but yeah, you could look at quantiles of the distribution and where it falls. Yes?
Outside of becoming computationally expensive, are you able to add conditional priors as many as you want?
Yes. We can make our models as complex as we want. As long as they follow these rules of you're calculating the probability of all these parameters on the left given the data, and that you just follow the kind of arrangement of things that now we have the likelihood given a parameter, and then the hyper prior for that, and for the conditional prior for that, and a bunch of them potentially, all the way over to having priors, hyper priors for each of the individual parameters. Yeah, we'll write some big ones. And we're going to look at structure as a model and the F model that I mentioned yesterday, and you'll start to see this gets big. And sometimes it's not actually that computationally expensive. It's not that hard. Okay. I've gotten lost in terms of time a little bit. Okay, so let's make good use of our time then and talk about genotype uncertainty. And so this is our third model. It's still multi-locus for allele frequencies, diversity, and now we're going to add a new set of parameters for genotype probabilities. And these genotype probabilities and our uncertainty are going to involve individual data. So individuals are barcoded rather than population pools being barcoded. So let's draw a little picture of that model. So we still have our allele frequencies. We have our genotypes and the vector of genotypes. We'll keep theta in there. Now I'll write my vector of allele counts that we have. I wrote it with as a vector. Previously, I wasn't writing as a vector, but I should have been. And we can add in n, which is the number of allele copies. We need that for our binomials, but we can make it explicit that we may have uneven sampling at our different loci, so we could have a whole vector of sampling intensity that we have, and that's fixed for a given sample. So now we're going to take a product across individuals and across all loci, so I is individuals. Because now we're going to need to keep track of individuals. Before we didn't have to, but now we're going to be thinking about genotypes per se. Because we have genotype uncertainty, we need to be thinking about the genotypes of individuals, and these are types of models that we're thinking about for the workshop. So now we're going to have a probability of, actually, if you guys don't mind, I'm going to change that Y to an X, just to distinguish that now we have genotypic data instead of allelic count data. Okay, so we have... the number of individuals that we sampled, okay, at every locus. That would have been in there previously as well. I just assumed that it was constant. For the binomial, we need to say how many draws did we have. So before we, for example, had the 200 allele copies, now it's going to be the number of individuals that you sample at a locus.
So it can vary from locus to locus.
So. Yeah, so if you have missing data, for example, because you didn't call a genotype, you just didn't get data at all, for example. So we have this XIJ. These are our genotypic data. And so that's going to be given now the genotype. And the number of individuals we'll keep in there as well, the number of individuals for which we have data. And we're going to keep going. So I'm just going to treat this as an unknown right now. We're sampling. This is the part of the likelihood, because this is for our next generation sequence data. These are, I'm catching up, my brain's catching up with my pen. The N in this case is the number of reads at that locus that you have. So this is reads. I've been talking for a while. So these are our read data. These are the counts of reads in different SNP states. So that we have a genotype for an individual, heterozygote, okay? And we're going to have a certain number of reads that are going to come from that genotype. So we're going to be able to model explicitly how much confidence we have in the genotype based on the intensity with which we sampled that parameter. OK? Okay, I apologize for getting mixed up for a minute. But this is going to, our likelihood here is for the stochastic process of sampling reads from a true underlying genotype. So we're going to keep going. So that's what this dot, dot, dot means. So we're going to multiply this. We're going to organize our equation where now genotype is a parameter itself that has a prior. So what's going to be the, what is genotype probability going to depend on? What's the probability of a genotype going to depend on? The allele frequency, okay? And so let's keep it simple and just think about SNPs, where we just have alternative states so that we can write the P sub J, the allele frequency at that locus. And how many trials are there going to be in a diploid individual from the underlying, for the underlying for the genotype? If there's some true frequency of that allele within an individual, where you have two trials, right? So it's going to be a binomial, and our allele frequency, or our genotype probability is going to be 0, 1, or 2, because we have two trials from this underlying probability of observing that allele. Okay. We'll keep going, and we'll keep the rest of the model the same. The P sub J given theta and our prior probability of theta. So there's some things to fill in. But to make sure we're on the same page, we're modeling read data, the number of reads that match the two alternative states. So for example, we could have 10 and 0 if you had 10x coverage at a locus for an individual. Okay? And that's going to depend on the genotype of that individual and the number of reads. The genotype of the individual, in turn, is going to be conditional on the allele frequency in the population. And the allele frequency is going to be conditional on the site frequency spectrum across the genome, or theta, as we had before. Okay? So this already is a model for genotype certainty. Uncertainty that has some information sharing, right? We're not looking at individuals in isolation. And yes, if you can think about some of the pipelines that we talked about yesterday in terms of calling SNPs and being able to infer genotype probabilities, in one case, you could treat an individual as if you didn't know where it came from. It just walked in the door and it's the only one you know about. But in some cases, it makes sense to think about populations from which they're sampled, and it's more likely that individuals that are sampled together come from a common distribution of allele frequencies, and so you can share information about them. Let's say something about the form of the likelihood. So this P of X given genotype and the read depth, that's going to be binomial distributed with basically genotype divided by 2 and the number of reads that you have, where genotype, as I said, can be 0, 1, or 2. Okay? We're going to model genotype here as a binomial with two draws. So at most, you could get two copies of the reference allele. You could get one copy or two. And so to model that up here, we're going to divide that by 2, so you can have 0, 0.5, or 1, okay, as your parameter. And that makes sense. A heterozygote, if you're taking stochastic samples from a heterozygote, you have a 50-50 probability of getting either allele, and you have a certain number of sampling intensity, the read count from that. Okay? So we just have to transform this here with just dividing it by 2 so that it puts it on a scale that makes sense. And then to make this explicit, the conditional prior that I've already said, the conditional prior on genotype this P of G, I, J, given the allele frequency at that locus, and a sampling of two alleles is binomial with P and N equals 2, or P sub J. Otherwise, it's the rest of the model is the same. The beta for the allele frequencies of locus given theta, and then the hyperprior for theta will keep the same as the previous model. So we've specified a model here for genotype uncertainty. I goofed it up and I had to go a little bit fast, so I apologize. But it's just binomial sampling from an underlying probability. You have in a homozygote of the alternative allele, you have a zero probability of sampling that. And so if you took a sampling of 100 reads from that locus, you should expect with high probability to never see the alternative. What we can do, of course, and what we didn't do, but it was mentioned yesterday by Nancy, is that we could include error in that part. So if you wanted to include error in your own model, it would be right here. And what it would do is it would change your probability in the binomial of observing your different states by error. And there are various different models that you could use at that stage in the model. Okay? But that's what it would do. You have a true genotype, and that true genotype has some probability of generating reads. You can assume there's no error, and then it just follows a simple binomial, or the frequencies. So, for example, you now have a non-zero probability of observing the alternative allele. Okay, it's no longer 0 and 1 for the two homozygotes. It becomes something slightly different than that because of error. Okay, because they can be converted into heterozygotes by error. All that said, the third alternative is that you can take the genotype likelihoods that come out of BCF tools and just put them right there so that you don't actually use your own likelihood here, a binomial. You use the numbers that are calculated from BCF tools as your data, in a sense. Okay, and you use those likelihood, or you actually don't use the data directly, you use the likelihoods that are obtained. And you use that posterior distribution that I was saying was weird, those three categorical values for a locus and the genotype probabilities. Those are now your likelihood. And they can come from more sophisticated models. They can come from models that not just take a single error rate for the whole genome or an error rate for that locus, but they can actually incorporate read quality and that type of thing. And there are good reasons to think that that might be the way to go. Okay, that rather than calculating the likelihood here, instead use the likelihood as input from another source. And that is a reasonable place for me to stop because I'm out of time. Yeah, I'll stop. I'll just say what I'll do next when I come back is that we'll modify this to where we don't have barcoded individuals, but we have a barcoded pool, and see how the math changes very slightly when we don't observe individuals directly, but we draw reads from a pool of individuals that went in together. So are there questions? I'm sure I muddled something up.